This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga, and here is what's coming up.
I, for one, have a special needs son. And when there's medication that's needed, if things need to happen and our batteries are running out, there's nothing we can do. Then you've got to scramble around trying to get decent care.
That's South Africa's resident Denise Govender, who is already struggling to cope with the country's electricity shortages, which appears to be getting worse. Also, a member of Tunisia's security services kills four and injures others. And health experts warn viral hepatitis could get worse if not addressed. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. A member of Tunisia's security services opened fire on Jewish pilgrims and fellow officers at the festival of Lag Bomar on the island of Djerba, killing five people and wounding several others before police fatally shot him. Reporter Elisia Walkman has more from Tunis.
The sound of gunshots and the cries of visitors brought the festivities of the Jewish festival of Lag Bomar to a sudden and tragic end on the island of Djerba, home to one of the oldest Jewish settlements outside of Israel. El Griba, Africa's oldest synagogue, has suffered previous terrorist attacks and is always under heavy armed guard. However, this hasn't discouraged Jewish pilgrims and tourists from all over the world from participating in the lively pilgrimage processions that have continued for over 2,500 years. Muslims as well as Jews visit the synagogue to light candles and write their wishes on eggs laid out there, hoping that God grants their dreams. Only this time it was their worst nightmares that came true.
We were just 100 meters away from the shooting when it happened. At first we didn't know what was happening and thought maybe it was just children playing with toy guns.
We were inside the tour bus in the parking lot outside El Griba Synagogue, and we had to stay inside the bus for about an hour before we could safely go outside. That was Professor Emeritus Habib Kazdahli, a scholar of Jewish history and culture who formerly taught at Manuba University in Tunis. Each year he organises a trip of some 20 students studying Tunisian Jewish history for seminars and to follow the festival. The Tunisian Ministry of Interior issued a statement on the incident. They said the attacker cut his colleague's throat before seizing weapons and ammunition and heading towards the synagogue, where he opened fire indiscriminately on security units stationed there. Police returned fire, shooting him dead, but not before the shooter had killed two pilgrims identified as Benjamin Hadath, a French Tunisian, and also Aviel Hadath, an Israeli Tunisian. Four other civilians were injured and taken to a hospital for treatment. Six security agents were injured, one in a critical condition, and two officers were killed. The Ministry of the Interior says an investigation is underway to discover the shooter's motivation, so it hasn't been labelled as a terrorist attack. Professor Kazdahli said the attack left survivors stunned and barely able to speak a word. We don't know what this means for Tunisia, but we are holding another seminar in the coming days, and scholars are joining us in solidarity against this attack. Many visitors scrambled to get early flights home amid scenes that one witness described as chaos. Normally, Lag Bomar is a joyful occasion and is seen as a symbol of Tunisia's famed religious tolerance. Following a rise of racial violence in Tunisia, concerns are being raised about a rise of anti-Jewish intolerance. For Voice of America Africa, I'm Elisia Folkman in Tunis, Tunisia.
The U.S. Ambassador to Libya, Richard Noland, says he agrees with the president of the Libyan Presidential Council, Mohamed Al-Menfi, on the importance of establishing a joint force to patrol the southern borders and ensure Libya is not used as a platform for meddling in Sudan. French website African Intelligence reported on the movements between a militia affiliated with LNA leader Khalifa Haftar's forces and the paramilitary RSF led by Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. Wolfgang Puzai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi.
for the time being, I would say not very significant. This area is rather far away from the main fighting places, which are around the greater Khartoum area, the center and the southwest of Sudan. And in contrast to several claims, for the time being, there is no evidence that there are weapons or ammunition deliveries from Libya to Sudan. The much longer border between Sudan and Chad and the border to the Central African Republic are by far more important for the rapid support force for the RSF to sustain the fight against the Sudanese army. The RSF recruits mainly from some Sudanese Arab tribes, the Abaila and the Bagara, who have also a strong presence in Chad and a smaller one in the Central African Republic. And they rely on their bonds within the clans and the tribes for supplying and sustaining the fight. But it's important to keep in mind, if the RSF is getting defeated in the south of Sudan, some of the units might very well try to escape in a fighting withdrawal to Libya, as they know this area already and the way to get there. The significance of this border between Sudan and Libya might therefore increase in the future. So such a Libyan army, Libyan national army joint force could serve the Libyans very well in the future.
French website Africa Intelligence reported on the movements between the Sobol Salam militia affiliated with LNA leader Khalifa Haftar's forces and the RSF led by Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. Africa Intelligence added that there are currently approximately 6,000 fighters from Sudan's Darfur region in Libya, and they had begun to move south towards the border. If that's true, what would that mean for the conflict in Sudan?
The Subul al-Aslam Brigade is more or less a militia of the Arab Asuwaya tribe in the Kufra area in the southeastern corner of Libya. The Asuwaya have been fighting with the indigenous inhabitants of the eastern Sahara, the dark-skinned Dubu, for centuries about the dominance of the Sahara trade, or what we call today smuggling. Their partners in what is now Sudan have been mainly the nomad Sudanese Arabs, the tribes, from which the Janjaweed, nowadays named the RSF, are recruiting from. So this smuggling, especially smuggling of fuel, is continuing also right now, albeit on a much lower level, as the neighboring region in Sudan, northern Darfur, is not under control of the RSF. But the vast majority of the armed Sudanese groups in Libya are from the Darfur rebel movements, who fought against the Janjaweed ever since. They are largely drawn from the Black African, Fur, Masalit, and Zagawa ethnic groups. And I would say all of them, Janjaweed and the others, their opponents, could return back home to Libya in the near future. Right now, they have started to return also already. Most of the Janjaweed are already back home, fighting with the RSF down against the government. And many of the other Darfur rebels are right now on the way back home, probably fighting on behalf of the former enemy, the Army of Sudan, against the RSF. So all this return of militias and fighters from Libya to Sudan could lead or will probably lead to a further escalation of fighting, especially in Western Sudan.
The U.S. ambassador expressed during a meeting with Chadian President Mohamed Idriss Deby his concern about the continuation of violence in Sudan, which may undermine efforts to restore peace in Libya. If the war in Sudan continues, how would that undermine stability in Libya?
There are two main challenges, refugees and the spillover from fighting. For the time being, there is no significant number of refugees from Sudan arriving in Libya. The vast majority has moved to Chad and the Central African Republic and some to Egypt. But this will probably change if the conflict continues. An increasing number of refugees can be expected that they attempt to cross the border into Libya on their way over the Mediterranean to Europe. This will be also another big business for the human traffickers. The authorities in Libya's Kufra district are already preparing for such a scenario, but I doubt that they will be able to handle it. So I expect that most of the refugees will move on towards the coast. And as mentioned before, if a larger number of RSF militias makes it into Libya, it could very well be the case that they will be pursued by their opponents, for example, these Darfuri groups. And this could lead to fighting in between the Sudanese armed groups within Libya. So altogether, no good news for Libya, especially not for its remote southeast.
That was Walfang Puzai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Al-Shanawi. Separate outbreaks of Marburg virus disease have been reported in Equatorial Guinea and in Tanzania, causing 12 deaths so far. Dr. Amesh Adalje, an infectious disease physician and senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, tells VOA's Caravan Dam via Skype It's the first time he's heard of the disease being reported in two countries on opposite sides of a continent.
It's unusual in the sense that we haven't had two simultaneous, non-contiguous Marburg outbreaks before, at least that I can remember. But I think it really speaks to the fact that this is a more widespread infection than we've thought, and that the reservoir host, the bats, are likely present in many parts of Africa. And as diagnostic testing gets more sophisticated in parts of Africa, more and more of these diseases are going to be uncovered, because in the past, they might not have been able to discover what was making people sick. In many of these cases, these one-offs or outbreaks might not have gotten diagnosed, or they might have been misdiagnosed. But increasingly, as diagnostic capacity increases in Africa, I think we will see more specific diagnoses like these Marburg outbreaks, like more Ebola outbreaks and other infectious diseases come to light.
Where is it noticeable in these two countries?
Well, they're in different. What's happening in Equatorial Guinea is that there are multiple provinces that are infected, including parts of that are near the port. But what's interesting is that some of them are non-contiguous, meaning that there likely are chains of transmission going on in Equatorial Guinea that have not come to light, that are undiscovered, that we can't figure out the transmission mechanism, telling you that there are people infected that haven't been diagnosed yet. So there's multiple provinces affected in Equatorial Guinea. And I think that's of the two Marburg outbreaks, that's the one people have the most concern about.
Have people died in either one of these countries?
Yeah, there have been fatalities in both. Marburg is a disease that has a high fatality rate. It's something that is related to Ebola, but unlike Ebola, there are no vaccines or medical countermeasures for Marburg, even though they're in the same viral family.
If there's no cure, what do health workers do to try to contain it and to help the people that are infected?
Marburg is a scary and deadly disease, but it's not a very contagious disease. It spreads through blood and body fluids. So the first thing people need to do is identify cases, isolate them, make sure that healthcare workers are taking care of these individuals with the appropriate personal protective equipment, that they come up with safe burial practices, because often with Marburg and Ebola outbreaks, a lot of transmission occurs when people are preparing dead bodies for burial. So you put those measures in place. And then the cases that you do have, you make sure that when they are getting treated, even though there's not specific therapy, that they're getting good supportive care, which means electrolyte replacement, IV fluids, fever control. All of that's part of how we treat Marburg, even if there's not a specific antiviral or monoclonal antibody that you can give them.
Does it usually start out, you see cases, multiple cases in one family, and then it spreads from there?
Well, usually these cases occur with a one-off case that then spreads to village workers or very close contacts. And yes, there is clustering amongst family, because family members tend to take care of other people in their family, and that affords the virus an opportunity to jump from person to person.
What are the symptoms?
So Marburg starts out kind of like any other viral illness. So fever, chills, muscle aches, and pains. Eventually, people can develop very severe fatigue, diarrhea, vomiting, unremitting fever, as well as sometimes in certain cases, they can get what are called hemorrhagic manifestations, where they may bleed from places where an IV might have been. They might bleed out of, they might have bleeding from their gastrointestinal tract. It is a viral hemorrhagic fever.
That's Dr. Amesh Adalja, an infectious disease physician and senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. He was speaking from Baltimore with my colleague, Carol Van Damme. Meanwhile, health agencies warn that viral hepatitis could kill more people by 2040 than HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria combined if it remains a neglected and underfunded disease. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports every year viral hepatitis, a potentially life-threatening liver infection, affects more than 350 million people globally and kills more than a million. It says the African region accounts for 26% of the global burden for hepatitis B and C, including 125,000 deaths. Kenneth Kabagambe, who contracted hepatitis B in 2012, founded the National Organization for People Living with Hepatitis B in Uganda. He says the organization aims to raise awareness of the disease and shatter the myths that stigmatize victims and discourage them from seeking help.
For example, there are issues to do with the myths and misconceptions, which actually are drawn from the lack of clear information about the transmission of hepatitis B and hepatitis C in the communities. These actually have led to domestic violences in some families because people think that hepatitis B is just casually transmitted, which is not correct.
Hepatitis B is spread through sexual transmission and through contact with the blood, open sores, or body fluids from a person infected with the disease. However, the main mode of transmission is from mother to child during birth and delivery. WHO reports around 70% of hepatitis B infections worldwide occur in Africa, and 70% of those infected with the disease are children younger than 5. Senior Director of the Viral Hepatitis Global Program at the Clinton Health Access Initiative, Auriel Fernandez, is based in Rwanda. She says the best way to prevent hepatitis B is by getting vaccinated. Unfortunately, she says, the first birth dose of this vaccine has very low coverage in Africa.
In the Africa region in 2021, only 17% of newborn babies in the WHO Africa region received a timely hepatitis B birth dose. And only 14 of the countries in the region have policies for routine Hep B birth dose vaccinations.
She says effective and affordable treatments are available for hepatitis B and hepatitis C, which is largely spread through unsafe drug injections. However, she adds poor countries need financial help to get these programs moving. Next week, the Hepatitis Fund and the Clinton Health Access Initiative is holding a high-level pledging conference, the first ever, in Geneva to address this issue and spur along the global elimination campaign. The conference hopes to raise $150 million. However, organizers note it will take between $7 and $8 billion to eliminate viral hepatitis by 2030. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was found liable yesterday for sexually abusing and defaming American writer Jane Carroll. Carr accused Trump of assaulting her in a New York department store dressing room in the mid-1990s, then caused her more trauma by calling her a liar after she spoke out. Jurors in the trial awarded her $5 million in damages. To find out more if the court case will affect Trump's chances of becoming president again, VOA's Carol Van Dam reached Alan Lichtman, distinguished professor of history at American University.
A judicial civil finding that an individual, a man, sexually abused and hurt a woman and then maliciously defamed her, that should stop, dead stop, any political career. It should be over. Herman Cain, the late Herman Cain, once a promising candidate for the Republican presidential nomination, had his career derailed because of allegations of sexual harassment. No court case. Al Franken, a Democratic senator from Minnesota, had to resign because of allegations, not court findings, of sexual harassment that were much less serious than what Trump was found to have done to E. Jean Carroll. But this is Donald Trump, the guy who said, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and it wouldn't hurt my base. He may be right about his base, because this is something that is just extraordinary about our politics and our society today. I call it the death of truth, because Donald Trump's supporters live in this insulated bubble where they're only fed information to already sustain and support what they believe. And they are entirely cut off from any critical information, however truthful. It's the deep state. It's the socialists. It's the Democrats. It's the mainstream media. So it doesn't matter how truthful the information or how many lies they are fed.
So you're talking about Fox News, you're talking about far-right media outlets when you say
more than that. I'm talking about social media. You got to understand social media creates a new kind of community. Communities used to be by proximity, your neighbors. Now it's communities by political inclination. And the algorithm simply feeds you things that reinforce what you already believe and insulate yourself from everything else. This is new. This is part of the new world in which we live. And I'm afraid, I'm not going to go into it in great depth, that, you know, AI, artificial intelligence, is only going to make this horrible situation much, much worse. So I don't think it's going to move Trump's base, but it is going to make it much more difficult for him to win a presidential election. One of the problems with punditry is, you know, the pundits and the media, no offense, you're all friends of mine, but you got to present a story every single day. And so you're fixated on, you know, the poll of the day. So there was all this gnashing and gashing about a poll showing Donald Trump beating Joe Biden by 6%. Pundits ready to write off Joe Biden a year and a half before the election. And just today, a new poll, a more recent poll, comes out showing Joe Biden leading Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis. But what is the same, what is common to all of these polls, is a very large number of undecided voters, 15% or so. And that's Trump's problem. It's hard to see that this verdict wouldn't hurt Trump with the undecideds.
That's Alan Lishman, presidential historian and distinguished professor of history at American University in Washington. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam.
On VOA Africa Radio, we let the sound tell you the story. News, sports, science, and entertainment available to you 24/7. Tune in on your local FM stations. We are also available on the medium waves, 909 kilohertz and 1530 kilohertz. Our short waves are 6080, 15580, 4930, 15165, 15580 and 17530 kilohertz. VOA Africa, your trusted source for news and information.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. For the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbu Yebro, and our engineer, Ajuan Kali, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on the